Craig Spivey. We met Craig. Top bloke. What a top bloke.
Amazing. Really, really interesting conversation. And somebody you can just chat to and just talk. It was a very good storyteller as well.
Some context. Craig was the guy that set up this TEDx thing with us. When we did the TEDx Leamington Spa, Craig was sort of the creative director. There was Kimberly Owen as well, who was kind of like the main kind of person behind all of it. But Craig had this kind of like creative director role. So sort of working quite a lot with him on that project. And he was just a cool guy, you know, and sort of knowing about his, some of the stuff he's done in the past and things like that. And he's just done cool stuff. He's been involved in cool things, and it was just nice to hear
some of the stories. It's just like, oh yes, and this happened, and then oh, and we spoke to this person that then ended up being this person and that person, and then suddenly we were talking to the president. not literally that that much, but
yeah
some of his stories are like, oh yeah, I got involved with this and I got involved with that, and then we got a little mention by this person, or I got involved with that. Literally, well, you'll hear, rather than me ruin the stories. Have a good listen to Craig and us chat.
Enjoy. I mean, your thing is, you're a creative, aren't you? You're a creative person.
I guess I am, yes.
where does that love of play come from? Because it's got to be rooted in play, right? Is that...
I think it probably is. And a little bit of showing off. And making people love me and all those deep-rooted things. But yeah, it is. It's a great job. I do get to muck about, and people sometimes pay me for it, which is a bonus.
And like... What's kind of, because it's visual, isn't it? Your primary domain.
It's largely visual. Yeah. I did a course when I first started working for myself about 2 years ago. I went on this course that the local authority had got some money from somewhere to do these courses to invest in creative startups. Mm. And the first night there was a kind of icebreaker. And they went around the room and they set this little challenge to describe what you did to a 7-year-old. And I got as far as ideas, words and pictures to help sell products and services. And I put that on my website. It's been the most crystallising kind of thing, kind of no nonsense, no bullshit kind of description of what I do. You know, and it can take many forms, but it's generally words, ideas and pictures.
Yeah. So what about sort of pre 2 years ago? Because I don't know much of your story kind of from them.
Well, I worked in agencies.
Yeah.
So I studied as a graphic designer, and I started work with a small agency in Coventry down the road from where I'd studied. Two guys I worked for, they'd done the course like 5 years previously and set up. So everyone was quite young. It would have been the late 80s, so still very analog. There'd be, you know, a piece of kit in the corner the size of a phone booth that did one job, and you'd have to have somebody trained to work it, and it would come with loads of like stuff, like materials, papers and chemicals and all manner of things. So to do what I do, you needed that around you, you know, and these little design agencies and advertising agencies, they were all in converted barns and old schools and things, because they needed that space, you know, because there was a lot of physical things that came with making what we came up with. So that's how you kind of start out. I didn't kind of leave college and suddenly work for myself, which you can do a bit more now. So I was there, cut my teeth, 10 years. We did a lot of cool things, had some good clients, Legoland, and it was one of my favourites. And then I kind of graduated up, left there, had a bit of a break from that career. There was friend of mine who was setting up a recruitment company for creative and marketing industries. And I kind of went and did that with her for a... Well, I lasted 11 months. I was kind of seduced by this idea of using what I'd learned to help other people go where they want to go, and it was quite kind of altruistic and all this kind of thing. But a big chunk of that job was getting on the phone and and hustling.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just sometimes it was a bit of a numbers game. You had a finite number of candidates and a finite number of people who might employ them, and you had to get in there before the other guys. And
oh, gosh.
Didn't really take to that. I used to love seeing people's portfolios, and sometimes people come to you and they had no clue, and you'd be able to kind of help them tell a story and make it better than the sum of its parts. But ultimately, I was seduced back into agency world again, and I joined a company called Vital, and they were sort of a bit of a league above where I'd started out. So bigger clients, bigger budgets, and yeah, I got to do that for about 13 years and then went alone about 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, what was that like, that step?
It was quite... it wasn't the big leap of faith that it might have been earlier. I knew lots of people. I was pretty comfortable in what I was doing. So, you know, and I'd you do, you attract work off the side of your desk anyway. So it was a question of sort of dialing that up and using your contacts and taking it seriously and saving your receipts.
Yeah.
Yeah, just for the tax man.
Yeah.
No, that's cool. And you've kind of, you know, through that journey, you've picked up some pretty cool clients, right?
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of them have been through people I've worked with before. And making your own opportunities. You know, I think what's nice about being my own man is you've only got yourself to answer for. So you can chase a bit of a dream and lose a, you know, invest in something, and you're not, you haven't got somebody kind of going, you're doing wasting 2 days on that. That's never going to go anywhere. Whereas I have sort of chased a few things and they've come off, and you know, they've been really rewarding, whether that was financially or whether it was just things like TED, which I'm sure we'll talk about, but you know, just really satisfying things to do. I did a job with a company called Helix in Starbridge and worked on their a reissue of their original Star Wars products from 1977 last year for the 40th anniversary, and it was just brilliant. And I'd never have kind of chased that. I'd have been working for an agency, really.
You know, one of the things where we've really connected is through the TEDx in Leamington Spa, and that's kind of like your baby with Kim, isn't it, really?
It's become so, I think, I mean, it's only been in Leamington for, this is the fifth year now. I came to it, I kind of got the bug for getting involved in local events, which, to rewind a little bit, you know, you go around towns and you see these banners across the main street, and they're always a bit horrible, always a bit nastily designed. And I saw
Comic Sans.
Yeah. And I saw this tweet go around for volunteers for a local history festival. And it was in the days when I was still at the agency, and it just struck me as a nice thing to do. You know, all kind of companies have a bit of CSR to fulfil and contribute back to the community. So I said to the gaffer, look, I'm going to volunteer for this, and we can help them do, we can help them, you know, have a nice logo and a nice programme, and it'd be good for the town. And so we got involved in that, and very quickly learnt that Tony Benn was going to be part of this history festival. He was coming to the town. So I kind of got a little bit more into it than maybe I would have done. Just because I had this opportunity to design a poster for Tony Benn and meet him and get it signed and all this kind of stuff, so sort of selfish reasons. And it was through getting involved in that, it spawned a the following year it took on a different life. The ladies, very sweet ladies who were organising this history festival, they came back, wanted the logo updating for the following year. And I said, oh, what's the big hook this year? You had Tony Benn last year. What's it going to be this year? And they said, well, we think we've got permission to go down the Victorian sewers in Leamington Spa. And we're like, okay. And I said, well, why don't you do something about, like, I don't know, that's a bit more, a different take on history. What about something about the games history in Leamington? So Leamington's got a real rich history in computer games, just by a quirk of geography. One of the biggest computer game studios in the 80s, Codemasters, kind of just pitched up in the town, just outside of the town, and it created this.
They're still there.
Little bubble. Yeah, they're in Southam.
Yeah.
And they got big, and people split off, and they grew little agencies. And
that's the two brothers, right?
So the Codemasters were the Darling brothers.
Yeah.
And they were the publishers. And then you had another pair of twins, the Oliver twins, and they were the creators of Dizzy Games.
Okay.
And all this. And they were like the guys who sat and coded it and created these games. And they were sort of like, they would work together. And but this whole, I could talk about that for an hour. but that spawned a really sort of quirky element to this chintzy little spa town of Leamington. And no one really, everybody in the town know somebody either works for one of these places or know somebody who knows somebody who works for these places, but no one had ever mapped it out, no one had ever kind of told this story. So I got involved in that, and we created this festival called Backspace. And we got a bit of money, we got some funding from the local council. It was at the time where they were trying to just encourage footfall in the towns. And one of the ideas we had was to get locally made games into different locations in the town and create a bit of a trail. So we had we built these arcade cabinets, and you could play locally made games, and kids could get a sticker, and they do a little trail, and they could enter into prize draw, all this sort of stuff. Anyway, it was massively successful, like way more than we thought it would be, and than it deserved to be, really, because it was done on the shoestring. It was done with a lot of passion, myself and. Somebody I've been told to get in touch with called Natalie, who I just got in touch with on LinkedIn, said, look, you know, you don't know me, but we've got this guy in common, and he suggested to talk to you about this, and, you know, here are the ideas. And she got on board, and it was fabulous. So we did that for 2 years, and it kind of ran out of manpower, really. It got bigger, and she was running her own company. I was, you know, 3 years into doing another Craigie passion project off the side of my desk, and the gaffer was, you know, he's testing his patience somewhat. So, but you kind of get that bug, you know, it's like, what's next? And we talked about doing a TED event as part of Backspace, because we'd seen that was a sort of thing that you could tap into, and it just was instant credibility. And it was one of those conversations we had over a pint, and it never went anywhere. And then I can't remember the exact order of events, but I think Kimberly, who I knew because I worked with her, had seen somebody was starting the TED in Leamington. It was a guy that was new to the town, wasn't part of any of those networks that we were part of. Canadian guy called Ryan. He'd gone, he'd applied, he was doing it all by the book. He's a brilliant sort of process guy. And he was looking for people to join his team. So I volunteered to do the sort of creative end. Kimberly came on as, I guess, social media and a bit of PR and just volunteering. And the first year was very much him sort of running the show. He had a very clear idea of how he wanted to do it. It was around the theme of Courageous Creations. That was the first theme. And that first year, you know, I didn't really know what we were doing. I kind of, you know, I was aware of TED and TEDx to some degree, and wasn't, you know, completely au fait with all the rules that were around it. But it was a lot. It was a pretty basic event that year. It was, you know, getting our feet sort of under the TEDx table and, you know, earning our place there. It was competent, and it was professional, and, you know, it still produced some of the best, you know, most viewed talks that we've ever had. And he moved on the second year, and, and Kimberly took on the license. And I think going into the second year, we knew a bit more about what we were doing, and we just upped the ante for the second year, and then upped it again for the third year, and then you're in for the fourth.
Yeah. So it's 4 years in now.
4 years in, yeah.
Will there be another year? Will there be a fifth year?
I'm the member that's dragging his heels. I'm like that. But yeah, I think we're kind of too deep into it now. I think five's a good number, isn't it, to do? And I'm kind of, you know, there's times when you run it, it's a volunteer gig. I think you need to kind of make that point like really clear, is that it's kind of done for the love, you know. We sell tickets, but that all goes back into the putting the event on. And there were times sort of on the run up that it felt like we were really struggling this year, because the world has changed. You know, in those short 4 years, you know, I think when we started, it was, what would it have been, 2015? You could do a tweet, and it would get retweeted, and everyone would kind of jump on it. Whereas even just like that social landscape in that time,
that's interesting.
We weren't getting
that
through, because it's all.
Unless you chuck 50 quid at it, 100.
Well, that's it, and you see, you chuck your money here, there, and it's and so you're fighting that. You're fighting the fact that it's not a new thing anymore. You're also fighting the fact that in the time we set up, you know, Coventry's got a TEDx now, and I think Warwick Town had got another one, and then I think so. People into that and wanted to experience that live experience had more choice around the year. And I think, you know, Leamington's quite an active town in terms of events. You know, there's always something going on. It's full of very capable and engaged citizens, you know, who kind of make stuff happen, which is great, you know. But, you know, we're just one of those events. So I think this year we really had to work hard to just get those bums on those seats. And it all came good, you know, sort of in the last few weeks before the deadline, you know, before the event. I think people kind of got their fingers out, but yeah, just different sort of ebbs and flows, I think, with these things.
And the other thing you touched on just a few minutes ago was your kind of Star Wars thing that you've got. But I remember one of the first things I saw you do before I even knew about you doing the TED stuff was actually you put on like a Star Wars like memorabilia museum type event.
In Nuneaton.
And I was like, wow, this, you know, you know, when you see someone and I hope you don't mind me saying this, but you meet so many people who have ideas and then don't follow through with them.
Yeah.
And you obviously, like, you go for it. You know
part,
what I mean?
Part of it is saying yes to things. Because you kind of go, oh, it's the worst that could happen. Let's just say yes. That was interesting. There was, I collect Star Wars memorabilia. Back to what you were saying at the start about play, you know, that's never left me. And whether it's that, those totemic items that link you to my childhood, or, you know, I'm sure that's part of it. Other parts is, you know, the graphic design thing. And a lot of the things I collect are quite print-based or packaging, things like that, and I love the art, I love the design, and I love the fact that it was created in an era before, you know, when it was still very analogue. So I kind of tend to focus on things that were made before 1985. But the exhibition came from Helix I mentioned as well. They created a set of stationery, like early doors, like right at the start of the Star Wars mania in the UK. They're exclusively sort of British items, and they're incredibly naive and bright and colourful and just you know, way before the days of very strict brand guidelines and copy and paste artwork. So they're an interpretation, you know, they're an interpretation of these characters aimed at kids in the 70s. So they are as colourful as, you know, they did a a Death Star pencil sharpener that was like a disco ball. Really bright colours. It's just like bizarre. And I always loved them, and I was kind of a bit ahead of the curve with them. So while everyone's chasing action figures and all the things that everyone thinks about when they think about Star Wars collectors, I was chasing pencil sharpeners and pencil cases. But so I, you know, built this little collection over the years, and I followed Helix on Twitter. I'd tried to get in touch with them a couple of times, but I'm just a nutcase. They tweeted a picture of an old math set, and they said, "We're trying to find the oldest, or is this the coolest old math set, you know, out there," kind of thing. And I just happened to have a photograph of my Star Wars Helix math set on my computer, and I tweeted them back. I said, "It's cool, but it's not as cool as mine." And it turned out it was the PR company that had been employed by Helix who were looking after their Twitter, and they saw this thing and they were like, "Oh my god, that's really cool." And we got into a conversation in sort of direct messaging about this stuff, and I sent them a picture of the collection as a whole, and they went, "This is amazing. We'd no idea that the company had ever produced stuff for Star Wars." And this was back on the run up to The Force Awakens, so this would have been sort of in the autumn time. And I said, "Look, you know, if you want to use any of it just to make that association with your business and the films that are getting, you know, re-energised, then feel free. I don't mind whatever you want to do." It's just shits and giggles, right? Mm. A few weeks later, they sort of sent me a message, said, "Look, we've drafted this press release. Are you cool with it? I want to make sure you're cool with it." It's just a little kind of article about how this stuff had survived and it was the kind of thing that people threw away, and some of the values it was kind of reaches, some of the prices it was fetching on eBay. And I said, "Yeah, that's fine, that could go out." And it got in places like the Coventry Evening Telegraph and the Birmingham Mail and things like that. But somebody at Nuneaton Museum and Art Gallery had seen this article, and they contacted... I think they contacted, like, Coventry Evening Telegraph, who contacted me and said, "Look, the Dunedin Museum are trying to get hold of you." And I said, "Oh, okay." So I, you know, phoned them back or whatever. And they said, "Oh, we want to, like, borrow some of your collection to put on display." And I said, "Okay, well, that's, you know," and some people had done exhibitions of Star Wars stuff before. It wasn't a new thing. And I said, "All right, let's have a chat about it." Anyway, I didn't say no, and I went and did my research, and it twigged later why Nuneaton, and it's the home of Gareth Edwards, who directed Rogue One.
Oh gosh!
And they were just trying to get a little bit of
recognition back.
Just a little town being proud of one of their sons. I thought, this is so cool. Why wouldn't you do it? So. So I said, "Yeah, let's do this thing," and it was just a nightmare of control and insurance, and because I wanted to put it on, obviously, and correctly direct it, and it was, you know, they were like, "Well, we just want your stuff, and we're going to do it our way, because there's a way of doing these things, because they're owned by the local authority," and
so
there was some to-ing and fro-ing and some very detailed diagrams, and it was 75% there, but yeah, that was something that I did. I thought, I know, there's another opportunity here. So I got back in touch with my friends at the PR company for Helix. And I said, "Look, this is doing this stuff. You know, this is happening. As part of the exhibition, I'm going to put all the Helix stuff on display. Do Helix want to sponsor the show?" And that might be a few hundred quid to do some posters, or it might be some pens and pencils to put in the corner for the kids to do the activities. And they went, "Yeah, that's cool." So I got to, it lent it that layer, that sort of air of authenticity, that, you know, this event was sponsored by Helix, and because it's very rare that you find a company that's actually still going that was involved. Gareth Edwards got in touch with the museum, and he was editing Rogue One at the time, and I got a lovely little sort of email from him saying, "This is great, you know, I started out my Star Wars career playing with toys in Nuneaton, and good on you." And there's a lovely message from his mum in the guest book.
That's cool.
That's wicked. I remember watching
watching the Rogue One, there was like a making of kind of thing, and he was right in there when he was directing. He was right in the shot and the action. It was almost on in view. You know, it was amazing. He was
360 kind of view, and they had camera guys dressed as soldiers, so that if they did happen to catch the shot, get in the shot,
didn't look so bad.
They blended in.
Yeah, and you'd think, why haven't people done that before?
I'm sure they have.
It's that one with the stormtrooper bangs his head off one of the X-wings on the original Star Wars.
One of the doors in the Death Star.
Oh, is that what it is? I mean, where does that... Because your love of Star Wars is gone from the film to the things, right? Is that a fair thing to say? Or is it like a combination of all the things?
It sounds like a combination of the love of the creativity and the artwork and that side of things, then into the films probably hit the right age bracket, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And then tying that together, the love of the films with the love of drawing and creating things has led to that, because you tend to find a lot of creative people like things that are made and, like you say, more analogue back in the day.
I think when I was a kid and that stuff landed, it was just, like you say, it was absolutely the right time. And those you think about the designs of those characters, the gold shiny fella and the little dustbin fella and the big sort of guy with the black helmet. And that it's stuff you could draw on your pencil case. Yeah, they're absolutely iconic. And the TIE fighters, you know, a little circle in a H shape, and you could draw a fleet of TIE fighters in under a minute. And it's just, I think that's part of it, absolutely.
Mad Seagulls.
Just part of that is part of the appeal. But I am a fan, you know. You do get collectors who, they're just about the collecting.
Yeah, they don't like the films, they just like the things.
Yeah, but I dress up and get all sorts.
Yeah, I think I've seen it. Dressed up as a Jedi for one of the things.
I dressed up as... I went to, I think my first, so they're these big conventions, and I'd been to one in London, and it was a bit more like a bit of English kind of sensibilities to these things. And I booked to go to the one in, it was the first one I went to in the States. I think it was LA. I thought, oh, I'm going to do this properly. And I went and bought myself an Obi-Wan kind of robes. I thought, I'm just going to go and just do it, you know. So I went along, and you know, you put it on, and I had hair and a beard, and it was okay, and I really enjoyed it, you know. And there was always the higher percentage of people dressed up. The UK's catching up, but it was nice, and occasionally somebody stopped you, asked for a photo, and you pose, and it was fun. But as my whiskers got like whiter and whiter, and then The Force Awakens came out, I said, oh, it's Luke. All right, going, okay. And I had to come to terms with the fact that, you know, as a 40-something, I looked more like a 64-year-old Mark Hamill than I did 32-year-old Ewan McGregor. But I wrapped my head around it, and I thought, well, I'm gonna see how far I can take this. So I went to found this like a pair of seamstresses in Coventry. And Force Awakens had been out, and there were a few, it was before the DVD and you could, Blu-ray, and you could get proper images. But there were a few images online, and I managed to get a few shots of the Luke's new robes. And I took them to this pair of Irish seamstresses who did Irish dancing costumes. That seemed to be the predominant like thing that they sold. And I took these photos. I said, do you think you'd have a crack at that? And they go, ah, they're just priest robes. We can make you some of those, no problem. So I was like... So they made all the stuff. They sourced the material, and I grew my hair out. And I went and did this event in London. I dressed up. And it was quite cool because it was a new character and it was a bit unusual. And the Irish Tourist Board were there. They recognised the potential in selling some of their locations as, you know, destinations for tourists. And they built this stand, and it was the steps of the, you know, Luke's island home with a backdrop and a Millennium Falcon for people to get a stand on and take photos, right? Yeah. So I was there with my mate. I said, come on, let's go find a Ray. Okay, let's go find a Ray, and we'll stand on the thing and we'll get a couple of shots. It'd be a nice thing to do. So we went round... these two 40-year-old men, like, scouting around for these young girls. So there's a good Ray, we'll get her. So we're going to go and stand on the island and take some photos. You want to come and do the pose, you know, so the lightsaber, holding the lightsaber out at the end of the film. And so yeah, she was game, so we went and did it, and the stand got mobbed. It was like, I felt like Father Christmas. It was just everyone was there and they took all the photos, and we came down, and then everybody wanted to stand between us and have a photograph with Luke and Ray. And it was just hilarious because I'd never done anything like that. It's not what you do, you know. And the Irish tourist board people who were manning the stand said that was brilliant. So we've had a few Luke's round sort of this weekend. He said, but that was far and away the best. He said, can we have your email? I said, yeah, it's my email. And when I got back, I thought that could be cool, right? So when I got back, I did a follow-up and said, nice to meet you. Just, you know, I was the guy who came, and just so they kind of remembered. And then didn't hear anything. And then I think it was a few months later, they said, well, we've got the World Travel Market at XL in London in November. Can you... what would you charge us to come and be Luke for the day?
No way.
And I'm like, I was trying this now, looking, like, going on these lookalike agencies sites to see. Because you kind of go, I really want to do it. I'll do it for nothing. But I've got to, like, so I ended up sort of plucking a figure out of the air that was comparable to my day rate. And and they said, yeah, that's fine. Turn up, and I just stood and posed with people all day long, taking photographs, and the Irish Minister for Tourism. And
wow, that's brilliant. If that isn't a thing about saying yes to stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, it is, it is.
One of the podcasts we did a while ago with Neil Johnston was to some degree along the same lines, because he was talking about curiosity, and he was talking about, like, you know, he's a really keen... you know, astrophotographer, well, photographer.
Yeah, amazing photographer. I'm familiar with him, yeah.
Yeah, and he was doing all sorts of bits and bobs, and he got into astrophotography just by walking past some guys with some, and going, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You know, and asking the question.
Yeah.
And that thing with the finding the ray, it reminded me of that. You know what I mean? That thing, shall we do this? Yeah, let's do it. You know, that kind of, like, the fit, the chart, the play thing is the, you know, the going, almost going back, reverting to childhood, and
dressing up,
not worrying about the fear, mucking about, judgment, and all those sort of things, and just, like, going and doing it and having the crack, you know.
Yeah.
That's ace, and not enough of that. we fear, we worry, you know. Should we do that? Oh, I don't know, are we allowed? Or, you know, you said something earlier about one of the guys you work with about rules and processes, and someone you work with is quite processy. And I've got this thing in some of the things that I do where I'm not. Rob will tell you, I'm the opposite of rules and processes, basically.
The phrase "herd in cats" was invented. what are we doing? Oh, we're doing this tonight. Oh, yeah, no, really? Are we?
Yeah, but that's where, you know, collaborations are valuable, and you get the right team together. And I mean, you know, just to reference Ted again, you know, that we've got the most kick-ass process guy in Paul Smith.
Mm.
Who just makes that stuff happen. He owns the lists, he owns the deadlines, and I've worked with him for a number of years, and I can have all these flights I fancy, and he's sending me emails going, t-shirts are due on Friday, because if you don't have them on Friday, they're not going to turn up for the event. And I need that in my life. I need those people.
But the other thing that I liked about sort of the way that you were when we were doing the TED stuff and putting all that kind of idea together was just your flow, you know, where you're quite happy to just follow a trail of an idea, and it will end up somewhere where the things connect eventually.
Yeah.
But you're quite happy to follow that flow, and like, oh, we've had this idea, just try that. And I've known, just to work. My day job is education.
Yeah.
You don't get many people like that. You get more of the processy rules type people that are sort of not into that, and you know.
I think what's great and what's liberating about working on a project like TEDx is that, you know, for parts of it, I'm my own client, and no one's really, and we have to fund an output at the end of the day. But if I want to go off on a tangent for 2 days, that's my decision, you know. And things that don't really, you know, they don't serve the event in and of itself. So things like the remix project is... that was just fun to do. It was just like, it was asking to be done. And, you know, with enough enthusiasm and enough talented people around you, you could... We pulled it off, and I'm so proud of that.
Yeah, yeah, it was really cool.
It was really good to do. And I think the people who we approached to do it were in turn scared and flattered and intimidated by it. But they did it, didn't they?
Yeah, they came through with it.
Mm.
And it was just, it was... I'll tell you what it was. It was amazing from that seed of an idea of, like, you know, saying, I think I said to you, I've got this thing on. Will it work? Does it fit? And then you kind of finding that part of it and going, yes, this bit will work. And then the journey of that was, like, pretty cool. But as you say, it was like, it had to happen. You know, it had to happen. Yeah. There was no choice in it. That was what was going to happen. It's funny about creative projects like that. I mean, with your Star Wars thing, was that the sort of same when you did the, you know, like getting Mary involved and things like that? Not in a fatey kind of cheesy kind of way, but in a way where you just think dots are connecting here. I've got to follow.
Yeah, I think so. So to continue the Star Wars story that started with the exhibition, we did a talk at the big celebration where I dressed up on the Helix range, and that was a proper nerdy kind of 300 grown men in a room. We packed the room, wanted to hear about pencil cases and stuff. But it was just this, you know, at the time it was a hot new collectible and everyone was familiar with the story of the figures and things. So we did that, and it was always part of the plan to involve Helix in some way, going back to the source. Because they didn't appreciate they'd worked on this stuff. It was lost to through the mist of time. And we went back after we'd given this talk in London to their office in Stourbridge. And we rocked up thinking we might get to talk to five people in marketing, the whole of the company. It was like, they had this meeting every 2 months. So we went, myself and Mark and Grant, who had worked on this talk with, were all sort of ushered to the back into the warehouse. And there were men in Viz vests, sort of like, you know, that's it, park forklift, and come and sit and listen to these guys talk about Star Wars stationery. Which we did, and they were, you know, interested. Mm. They were interested. I mean, Star Wars is such a... everyone has some touch point with it. Mm-hmm. So even the old ladies who, you know, ran the canteen, they kind of knew it.
The cantina.
And we did that, and they revealed to us that they'd been in conversations with Disney. It was the 40th anniversary coming up, and they'd got a license to reissue a selection of the stationery that they'd made back in 77, which was great. And they took some of my items to take, you know, to redo the designs from, because they didn't have anything left in their archives. And that was a real kind of moment where you kind of go, oh yeah, I've got an opportunity here. So Mark, who was one of my collecting buddies that I got to know putting the talk together, he's a really talented illustrator and designer in his own right, and had done stuff, sort of licensed material for Lucasfilm before. Grant at the time he's a podcaster. He was very big in the scene and the media side of things. I said, look, well, this is what we do as a day job when we're not talking about pencil cases. This is the kind of stuff we're doing. So how about we go away and we come up with some ideas of how we might like these things marketed to us as collectors, and we'll call it a pitch, and if you don't like it, we'll walk away. Anyway, we did, you know, we had a whale of a time with it. And we went back sort of after the Christmas time, presented this work to them, and they were very impressed. They were very impressed, and we managed to turn it into some paid work. Mm-hmm. So we did lots and lots of ideas for all kinds of things, but what ended up being produced was like a social media campaign. So we did a series of animations all based on sort of quotes from the film. So it like, that's no moon, it's space stationery, was probably the flagship ad. But we had, you know, little things with the rulers going, you know, short for a stormtrooper, and, you know, we just had some fun with it, and it was a real paid gig, you know. I got to work on some proper Star Wars stuff, and it was, again, it's sort of making those opportunities, chasing those not even leads, that sounds really horrible and sort of marketing-y and, and kind of forced. It is quite organic and there is a flow to it. And it's about, you know, being friendly with people and human and, you know, whether it's the people at the Irish Tourist Board or the Helix guys, you know, you sort of connect with them and you follow it up, you know. Kind of go, well, that might be fun. Should we do that?
Do you think people are more open to that again now? Because it seemed like for a long time it was like, no, we have the pitch in this format, it's this profile, you know. Do you think people are kind of more open to flow these days?
I think people like it when they connect with an individual and there's some trust there. And yeah, I mean, I've done jobs where it's been, I did one the other week, last minute, no time to go through a whole shitload of stakeholders. It's like, okay, well, if I'm going to deliver this, you just have to trust me. And I went, yeah, I'm sure it'll be brilliant. And he got signed off with no changes and off it goes to print. And I think in the business world, I'm finding as a self-employed person that really works for me. In the agency world can be wrapped up in process, and I'll have a word with the scheduling department and see if we can get that in for you and that kind of stuff. And if I'm wanting to buy something that's got a bit of soul to it, instantly it's a commodity. And I think working for myself, I do get to bring a bit of sort of myself to these jobs, and the client sees it face to face, and they feel the passion.
Human element you're talking about, the soul element, the real. That's real. That's right. You know, that's kind of the stuff that comes out that's relevant. And sometimes you can't box that. Sometimes you can't put that in a spreadsheet or a schedule or you just got to trust that that's got to happen, you know.
And you do, you can come unstuck when you're pitching for certain pieces of work and they are scoring you, you know. So a big, like a local authority piece of work, which I find myself on the confronting those forms, and they're very right or wrong,
very rigid. And from the other side, I've had to do some stuff where we've had to get companies in to do things at work. You have to, if you don't have some of that rigidity from that perspective, you then leave yourself open to claims that you're not fair in the process. And you can't leave yourself open to that. You have to give everybody the same opportunities, which means in some of these processes, if the three of us were pitching for something and you asked a question, they've got to give us the same answer that they've given you. Because otherwise you've potentially had an advantage the others haven't. And that's where that rigidity from that side has to come in there. But you're right, it's how you manage that against allowing the people, if you want them to be creative, how you let them show their creativity within that process is what's really difficult.
So I know when I've pitched for work for our local council that it's the same form that they use to judge the guy who, you know, the company that produces and supplies the wheelie bins, you know. And it's, but you know it's come from a place where, you know, at some point in their history, somebody's brother-in-law runs a building firm and they've done the council houses up and they've got caught out by it, so they put these things in place so that that doesn't happen again. So I totally get it. Which is nice when I get work that's come through people I know or people I've got, their ex-clients or ex-colleagues or friends in some instances, you know.
We've got collecting, Star Wars stuff, becoming Luke. I know, I think I saw recently you become more involved from a football perspective. And then recently you've been to New York as well. So adventure wise, how was being in New York and seeing all the creativity and the things over there? Was that inspirational?
Hugely. I mean, it's hard not to get inspired in a place like New York. I mean, my travelling has increased massively in the last few years since I've been hanging out with Kimberly, who is a restless spirit and is always on the move. And I'm very lucky to be in her orbit and get sort of swept along by it. So yeah, New York was great. We went back to the States in April to the next Star Wars celebrations. Hopefully, if Mary's not too busy, we might even get to see her. At least a wave across the room. So yeah, travel is good, but you know, you can travel from your device these days. You can soak up whatever you need to. And the football thing was interesting because I'm not a follower of sports in any capacity, really. But the guys, again, back to what we were just talking about, my days of working with Barclaycard in my agency days, they, through their careers, found themselves working for Chelsea Football Club. And I got a message one day. And I think it was through Facebook. I honestly think it was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, back to sort of clients becoming friends and that line blurring. I got a message from Sharon, who works at Chelsea, and she said, "Would you be interested in coming and working on some briefs for the club?" And first thing I said was, "I'm not really into football." And she said, "That's not what we're buying." I was like, "Okay, well, as long as that bit of the conversation's out of the way, we can crack on." So I did some projects for them over the course of the year just gone, and you know, found our way. You know, it's a new kind of field for me to work in. Although I'd done work on Barclay Premiership over the years, and Principality, a building society in Wales that sponsored the rugby, and I'd done ATP tennis. So I'd sported, you know, it's always been part of sort of what I'd done in my career. But what I do know about is fans and fandom and how that passion works and how fans have a real good nose for what's phony and you know, things like that. So I did find myself bringing some of those. Again, bring Mary up again. What she does with making that inclusive and bringing the fans on board. You know, that's something that the football clubs, they're very aware of. You know, I mean, my instinct is always to write, you know, funny copy lines, but a lot of it got bounced because it's kind of like, well, you sound like the club talking down to them. You sound like Tesco's. You have to use their language and you know, that kind of stuff.
And then New York, you've actually visited the TED. Headquarters itself.
We HQ, did. Yeah. So it's kind of everything I wanted it to be, really. It's beanbags and shit. it was, I mean, it wasn't, Kimberly's got a contact there. He's the guy that runs their social media. And it was just, you know, one of the, so we're in town, you know, to meet up for a coffee. So we went along and it really sort of struck me just where we fitted in. You know, it's very easy working on our little event in Leamington to be very focused on the town, but go in there and you walk in and you see, you know, they've got big photographs of all the different venues around the world that they've had these sort of unique and crazy events, and you go, oh, we're part of that. And I felt really sort of chuffed that we were, you know, living up to it. I think, you know, you look at some events and they're held in schools and sports halls and things, and they're, you know, as long as you manage to print out the big red letters and stick them up with the blue tag, you're kind of okay, you know. It's so we always try and elevate it a little bit beyond that. You go and you meet these guys, you think that, you know, we're not on their radar, and they are. Oh, well, you know, we loved that venue that you you know, you were in last year. It's like they know. They said they'd use some pictures of my kids holding the letters from years ago and one of their big presentations, and he's struck by the, I don't know, I guess the power of that brand. One of my favourite little moments when it first came to Leamington, we first announced it, we borrowed the letters from Birmingham or Warwick, I don't remember where. Anyway, we got these big red letters. So we'll go and we'll take them round town. And we'll just prop them up in front of some things and we'll take some pictures and we'll just put them on social media and say, you know, Ted's coming to Leamington. And we were crossing a zebra crossing, and there was me and Kimberly and the kids, and we all had a little letter each. And we were out of order, you know, someone had the tea, someone had the eat, and we were crossing this zebra crossing. This woman stopped us in the middle of the road and went, "Is that Ted? Is that Ted Talks? Is Ted coming to Leamington?" Wow. And it was just those big red Helvetica letters. Just in, completely out of context. This woman just clocked them, knew instantly what it was, and you just think, wow, that's that's powerful, you know?
Yeah. And as you say, I mean, you know, they've got processes and rules, and they've got the things they've got to do, haven't they, with when you put a thing together and do one of their events and all that sort of stuff. But, like, interestingly, that you've got, the vibe I've got from you when you're visiting in New York is that it's actually the human aspect and the community aspect that really kind of hooks you, you know, you really got from that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, everyone, you know, you've all done show rounds around companies when you've gone to visit places and people look up from their desks and they give you a nod. And we went in there and, you know, to be fair, Kimberly's got, she owns those relationships. I was just tagging along. But they all stopped what they were doing and turned around and had a chat and said, oh, you're coming to summit. So their big summit's in Edinburgh, I think, this year.
Right.
So they were all talking about when they were going to meet up and do this thing. And it's, yeah, great organisation. And, you know, like I said, when I started this thing, it felt like the next logical step to get involved in a local event. And it was it was all very local, and it's going to be TEDx Leamington Spa, and I've come from doing the History Festival and the Games thing, and this seems like the next logical step. It wasn't really until sort of the day, really, and the after, when you get the videos on they go global, that you realise that this is not just a little Leamington thing. And it took that first year and into the second year for us to really understand what we were doing and articulate what we were doing. And it sort of came to something along the lines of giving sort of some of the best minds of Leamington that world stage, but also bringing some of the best minds in the world to Leamington. And it was like a two-way thing. And that sort of became a bit of a kind of barometer, a bit of a kind of, you know, way of measuring whether we got the right mix of people. So to have you know, Pete in a local company talking about AR, and then having Mary from Alaska coming in talking about global fandom, it just that blend was just delicious, you know, really really cool.
So Rhythm is the one this year, and obviously the go-to thing is obviously Rhythm of Movement, dance, music, that sort of thing. But then you had people talking about, you had Anna talking about her heart research.
Yeah.
You had Sadar talking about the cars and everything else. So how do you make those choices as to what can fit into that context? And then how do you get those people from all over the world to turn up?
It's, I mean, the themes are loose. You know, the themes are, they're all deliberately broad. And the year before we did Rhythm, we did Home, and we went to TED head office with it and said we want to do Home, and we got a bit of pushback from them saying, well, that's too narrow. And you know, Kimberly's doing the emails and I'm sat on the sofa going, it's not bloody narrow, it's not bloody narrow at all, it's as big as the planet, it's as small as your front room. And so I ended up writing this I ended up writing an email that kind of was that talked about that scope, whether it's you know, it's a place or it's a feeling or it's a global issue or it's a local issue. And I said, send them that, and we had to sort of convince them that it was a broad topic. And that email ended up being sort of slightly modified and became the sort of manifesto for the event. And it just worked really nicely. There's something nice about a one word theme that had that that scope. So Rhythm was one that we talked about when we talked about doing Home, and we kind of kept in the back of our minds and revisited it the following year. But I think, you know, everything's got a rhythm. And this idea of, like, the rhythm of the commute was where Siddhartha's came from, the rhythm of coding, which is where Pete's came from. I mean, the heartbeats are a relatively obvious one. And, you know, most things will fit if you look at it in a certain way. You know, we're not strict about that sort of curation. And again, you know, some people are, they come to us. In other instances, we go to them. And again, it's a blend of that would be interesting. Let's see if we can get hold of them or get hold of their PR people. And and then we get people emailing us going, you know, I work here and I do this and I've got an idea that's this. And you kind of go, well, that's really quite interesting. We'll meet them. And, you know, so you've got really experienced speakers on stage and you've got people who've never done it before. And, yeah, it makes it interesting.
That velocity of ideas in one day is incredible. You know, just you just leave it going, that, yeah, got it. That's just amazing.
It's quite exhausting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, you know, for all the things I do and help people flog things and all the rest of it in my day job, I so there's an immense amount of pride just standing back and looking at that and going, we gave them a platform and, you know, it wasn't all about me. I was behind a curtain, you know, and that's really nice. Yeah, I think I'm talking myself back into doing the fifth one, aren't I?
I think five's a great number, but six is even better.
Yeah. Once we get a theme and we get a couple of people, you know, associated with it, it just takes on a life. We're not limited by our imaginations. We're limited by what we can physically do and the people that we've got around us that we can trust to do it. You know, you need money to put it on. And I think, you know, the plan is to get hit that harder and heavier and get some of that secured a bit earlier this time around, and be smarter with venues and things, you know. That's, you know, we make a run for our own back because we move it around. So we had it in the Spa Centre, which is a very basic, you know, theatre setup. So everything was there. It was easy. But it was a bit bland. So it's, well, let's move it to edit in the pump rooms next year. It's like a Victorian sort of, you know, part of the spa complex. Odd shape, you know, weird vibe, bizarre catering. We had to build the stage out and all the kind of stuff, and that brought its own problems. And then the third year, we did it in a massive church. When you think about it, churches are designed for lots of people to sit, face one direction, and watch a bloke talking or a lady. So you'd think that would be, you know, great. Oh, Jesus, it was hard. So yeah, we had to bring all the kit in, and again, you know, but you learn something every time, and there's an expense somewhere. So the expense last time was putting all that in, you know.
So is that the second time you've been at the venue from this year, or is that?
So the Assembly was the first year. So this last time was the first year we've done the Assembly. So we've done it for 4 years and done it in four different venues.
But did you bring it back to a theatre based on your experience over the previous 3 years? But to, as you said,
yeah, a little bit, because they, I mean, it was rhythm, and the venue's first and foremost like a gig venue, so it fitted, it felt right. And then of course they go, well, yes, you know, we'll charge you for the, you know, the use of the building and the kit and the people, but it's going to be cheaper than having to buy it in separately and load it into a church. So it was a lot of work. Still,
It felt like a very good venue. I know I got a slightly different experience to people who just come and see it as viewers, seeing the backstage stuff, but it felt like having the backstage, just the fact it was a theatre, the fact you could have somewhere for the people who were going to be performing to relax and then to get ready and then to come up towards. It felt, when you walked up those stairs, even though when you were walking up between the breaks to go and sit in the audience as I was, it felt like an experience coming from the back up to the front. Felt like you were preparing for something, even if you were just coming up to just watch, to then sit. And then we purposely sat, Andy was with us, wasn't he? And the guys joined later on after they'd done their bit. And we purposely sat at the back so we could tech it all in and see everywhere, just by the stage for the techs and everything. It just felt epics. Not too small a word for it, I think it's...
Yeah, it was a really nice venue, and there's a bit. It's got a bit of presence, that place. Art Deco Assembly Hall. And it did work. Our fear was, like, it feeling empty, because you sort of squashed people to the front, but I don't think that was an issue on the day. And then the year before that, it was in the church, and it's in November in a big, drafty church, and part of the thing we did was we had blankets. So that's another thing we have to sort of creatively think around. Okay, it's cold. Cost us like shit ton of money to put the heat in on. So I came up with this idea that we had the blankets, and you could you bought the blanket, and you could take it with you, or you paid slightly less as a donation, and you left the blanket. We gave them all to the homeless.
Yeah.
So these little problems present kind of opportunities and nice ways to do something.
Yeah. You can use walls. You can use them to climb. You know. You can, yeah. If something's in the way, you can use it, can't you?
Yeah. But that felt like a happening. The one in the church, because you had all these people just like, as the day went on and it got darker, people were just like, you know, the chairs got a bit moved around and people were on blankets and there's just stuff lying everywhere. And it just felt like a totally unique vibe. And part of the thing we had to do that year was, and I was a real beam up on it about it, was making it feel like you were in a church, not at church.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And even just simple things like getting rid of the centre aisle stopped it feeling like a church. Really weird. Mm. And it's a very opulent, kind of grand building. And because it was, the theme was home, I had this idea to build the stage out of cardboard boxes.
Mm.
So, you know, we've all moved house at some point and you've used cardboard boxes, and it's obviously something you associate with rough sleeping. So this idea of this cardboard box was cheap, because obviously we're on a budget.
Yeah.
So we constructed this stage out of cardboard boxes, and it had scaffolding going up to the, I don't know what the official term is for it, the big gate thing that sits in front of the altar. I'm sure there's a word.
The big bit.
Yeah. And we built this stage, and then one of the little things that I did was created fake logos that related to each of the talks. We'd talk about the asylum seekers' camps in Calais, so I did these fake wine boxes and the bottles were broken. And fun's the wrong word. Quite thought-provoking in cases. Things about the care system and sort of handling with cares, but they're all like, they all had little twists to them. And I'm sure like 95% of the people sitting there wouldn't have seen them. Yeah. But,
it's little things like that that show the passion and the investment that you guys have in that, whether somebody notices it or not, it's that thing that you know it's there.
Mm.
It's some of the bits we try and do with different things for circularity is we know we've done it.
Yeah.
And if nobody notices that we've done it, it doesn't really matter. We know we've done the right thing and we've put that extra effort into something. It just makes it feel slightly different.
Yeah, and a few of the speakers took the boxes that related to them home, which was nice. And we're playing with the idea of, and this hasn't gone really between any further than me and Kimberly, but this idea of outsiders. I want to call it freaks and geeks, but Kimberly quite rightly said that you probably have trouble kind of getting people to sign up to that. So that kind of got softened a little bit. But this idea of outsiders and the outsider view really interested me.
I loved Bohemian Rhapsody. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it.
There's a bit where it says I can't remember the exact quote. I'm rubbish at this kind of stuff. But there's this line around the idea of, look, that we're all just misfits, but we're performing to all the other misfits.
Mm.
You know, and I quite like that, the idea that they brought together this culture of people who felt like they didn't belong.
Yeah.
And they were the people that watched the gig and were part of that family, you know, right at the beginning.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's justification.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether that'll go anywhere or not, whether somebody will come up with a better idea. But it feels broad enough, and it's got the creative potential to do something a bit jarring and different. But what I quite like about TED is it's got a very, very pared down and basic toolkit. You've got Helvetica, you've got red, and you've got black. And I really like that palette to play with. You know, you look at other events and they kind of introduce different colours, introduce different fonts and things like that. I like to keep it quite pure. There's something in that appeals to me that you can explore. Cool. Now, before we finish, I just want to say thank you to you two guys and everyone else involved, because what you do, and I was kind of aware of circularity, but I didn't have the understanding that that has come through just being involved with the TED project this last year. But what you do on a very simple level gives my Facebook timeline a little dose of reality and a little dose of hope.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to thank you for that on the mic.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice one, man. Yeah, yeah.
I might not read every single one or click on every single link, but it's just brought that different way of looking at the world into my life, and you know, as a case study of one, that's thumbs up from me.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Nice one.
Yeah,
it's in.
Yes, so a lovely conversation with Craig.
Yeah, and for some very kind words at the end, so...
Yeah, he didn't have to say that, did he?
No, we didn't pay him.
No, we didn't pay him. But I like that line. I think we might abuse that line. A little bit of hope in my news feed. Quite nice. We'll keep that. We'll put that on the group or something. Also, I can't remember whether this went on record or not, but I think we should put it out there on record in that, like... I sort of put myself forward to get involved with their TEDx thing next year.
Yes, I don't think we did.
No, so that's it. That's public now. To sort of help them do the thing and be involved in some way. So that's exciting.
Yeah, and we may be looking at local opportunities as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll keep you abridged. Obviously, if you want something akin to a TEDx experience, come see us at Circularity Connect. Every 3 months at the National Brewery Centre.
Go to circularity.org/events and you see all the yearly events there, and with a little write-up about each one is. The Connects are cool. They're just you leave inspired from them, don't you? You leave like you've kind of connected with people, as it says on the tin, but also you've kind of learned something or you've explored something.
We've had our first one of this year already. And in that, that was based on the circular economy. So we looked at some stuff from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, something from a short film from the DIF.
Yeah, Disruptive Innovation Festival.
And that looked at Fab Labs and...
Yeah, it's good.
All the stuff around the world that they do. And then a talk from Ellen MacArthur as well, and we had some really great discussions with the group of people that were there about those thoughts and those ideas and how we could apply them locally and nationally, globally, and how we could do things differently as individuals as well.
Yeah, so that Prezi that we did from there, that's publicly available. You can have a look at that. If you go to our Facebook group and do a search for Prezi, you'll probably find it.
We'll put the link in the description.
That's a clever thing to do. Yeah, we'll do that. it's worth a look. It probably takes about an hour to watch it all. If you're going to watch it, it's also got our TEDx performance on it, actually. Yeah. It's got the bit about Craig and Kimberly and the different people who we've also done podcasts with and are hoping to do podcasts with from that. So, all good stuff going forward. Anyway, we'll be back in a couple of weeks.
Bye.